From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the first Monday in October, the beginning of the term for the United States Supreme Court. And of course, we'll preview the cases and issues that could come before the justices, but let's be honest, people aren't thinking about the enforceability of arbitration agreements right now. They're thinking about a court with or without Brett Kavanaugh and the condition of the court after all this dust settles. We'll talk about that too after this.
The news cycle is moving incredibly fast these days. KUER brings you national and international coverage from NPR and the BBC. And the reporters in our own newsroom are following the Utah stories that affect your community. You can count on us for news and conversation that's calm, fair, and fact-based. Now we're counting on you to support that commitment during our fall fund drive. Make a one-time donation or become one of our 9,000 monthly sustainers. Go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, Brett Kavanaugh had nothing to do with the cases now before the Supreme Court. I think all of them were already on the docket. Some of them were in place before Justice Anthony Kennedy announced he was leaving. But for obvious reasons, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings are the only thing people are talking about right now when it comes to the Supreme Court. And the hearings, the emotional and raw testimony last week, has raised some big questions, of course, not just about what might have happened in the summer of 1982, but big questions about this process. Is it a job interview or is it a criminal case? How much has raw political maneuvering motivated this spectacle? Is the legitimacy of the Supreme Court being jeopardized in some way? And right now, who's in the center of the court anyway? Today, of course, is the first Monday in October, the traditional first day of the Supreme Court's term. And so we're going to be talking about those larger questions and, of course, the particular ones that come from the cases before the court this year, because, of course, there are those, plenty of cases, in fact, to talk about. Today on the program, joining us are usuals, Ronell Anderson-Jones, a law professor at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writes about media and the Supreme Court. And Professor, welcome back.
Hi, great to be here.
And Amy Wildermuth is back with us, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Of course, moved from the University of Utah, where she's still an adjunct professor. She clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens, and her work focuses on the Supreme Court and on administrative law. There's an administrative law case we can talk about.
That's right.
Today. Yeah. Congratulations. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Well, we have to begin with the obvious, of course, and this is the extremely emotional and dramatic turn of events during the confirmation process of Brett Kavanaugh. And I want to get a sense of what you think this means for the court as we go. But first, just I wanted to get your reaction. This isn't the first time we've had something like this, of course, play out in public. But as observers of the court, you know, beyond the legal stuff, because you also think about the abstract and the social dynamics of the court, what do you think about all of this? Silence.
It was a hard week.
Yeah.
It was a hard week for the country, and I think a hard week for the court. The court actually likes to be the sort of institution that people don't think about all that much, and certainly likes to be the sort of institution that people don't think about when they think about rancor of politics and partisanship. And so on all fronts, right? I mean, I was traveling during this time, and I was surprised to see – I mean, I knew that I would be, you know, running from place to place trying to get connected to follow the proceedings, right, to be hooked into the hearings. But I follow the Supreme Court for a living.
Yeah.
But I was surprised to see how many people around me were doing that, right? Random travelers in airports gathered around TV sets and hooked up to broadcasts. It is
glued.
Glued. Right. It was the story of the week and probably the story of the year.
Yep.
And maybe the story of a lifetime for a lot of folks in terms of the Supreme Court. And I think that that's problematic on lots and lots of levels.
Yeah. What did you think?
And the truly unfortunate thing here is that this isn't really about the Supreme Court. This is about the dysfunction of Congress, and we ought to call it what it is. The dysfunction of Congress has been highlighted in the past in this sort of focus that we've had on the Supreme Court. We keep asking the Supreme Court to resolve all these major social questions, and it's not, in fact, always been true that that's what the Supreme Court's role is or should be.
They're just supposed to adjudicate what Congress comes up with,
this
right?
This is a check and balance, yeah. Right? That's the way the system works, and Congress has failed to answer so many questions, again, as a result of that dysfunction. And now we have yet another instance of what I think many observers are seeing as the true dysfunction in the Congress. And it's extraordinarily disappointing.
What does the Constitution tell us about the advice and consent process? I think that's really interesting, this idea that Kavanaugh has talked about wanting quote-unquote due process. Is that how it's supposed to work? I don't see anything about hearings in the Constitution in regards to advice and consent, so it seems like we've made this up as we've gone along.
And we're flying blind a little bit here, right? And part of the question is what this hearing is designed to be, and you see radically different views about what's supposed to be happening at this hearing. And part of the reason that that is the case is that we don't have great answers. We certainly don't have constitutional textual answers, right? Yeah. Advice and consent are literally the only words contained within the Constitution on this process. And in relatively recent history, in terms of the entirety of American jurisprudence, there weren't even public hearings, right? As recently as 1940s or 1950s, we had the advice and consent was happening on an individual basis. Every individual senator would sort of meet with, if he or she chose to do so, the candidate, the nominee, and make their own determination on the basis of whatever evidence they gathered about whether they would vote up or down on this nominee. The public hearing was a relatively recent development, and certainly the televised public hearing, the first to be televised was Justice O'Connor in 1980. So the sort of nation stops and watches this happen as a political spectacle, and as a spectacle at which every senator will have a great incentive to take advantage of the free TV time to sort of pontificate about their own partisan positions, is a very recent development, and one that a number of justices on the court have spoken publicly about their concerns about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that the evolution here that Ronell's describing has only gone towards more partisan aims and partisan results in the end. And what kind of damage does that do to the Supreme Court? I think we're starting to see that. And it's unfortunate, again, because we should remember the Supreme Court had nothing to do with the nomination of Justice Kavanaugh. He, of course, was a clerk there. But this is an institution that is relying on the president and the Senate to do their job to get folks there. But the collateral damage to the Supreme Court at this point is just very, very high, in my view.
You have a few things going on. You know, one is this question is, you know, of whether Judge Kavanaugh did sexually assault Dr. Ford or Deborah Ramirez or anyone else, and whether or not that's, you know, disqualifying. But then there's also this question of what this process has revealed about Kavanaugh's disposition to be on the Supreme Court. Some thought his reaction was surprisingly partisan and not to mention combative, and that he did seem to hedge and dissemble on certain things. Amy, what do you think that revealed about Brett Kavanaugh? And I mean, the idea that he went to the partisan part, I think, surprised a lot of people.
I think it was surprising. And I think the one thing that we can say with confidence here is that being on the Supreme Court was clearly something that Judge Kavanaugh has had in his mind for some time. This is something that is clearly worth it to him in terms of the steps that he decided to take and where he was going to go with this. I have to say, though, again, I believe it has done damage. I think it's done damage to him. It's done damage to the institution of the Supreme Court. And it makes us all sort of disappointed in the process, no matter what side of this you are on. The fact that, you know, there's some who say the fact that he had to do this, you know, that's what the real problem was, the fact that he got up there and did what he did. I mean, you can get it from either direction here. And again, the result is not a good one for the Supreme Court.
Randall, one of the things you had mentioned to us is that Chief Justice Roberts right now is probably working really hard behind the scenes to preserve the legitimacy of the institution. And I'm wondering, we don't know, obviously, but he must have winced just a bit when he heard the partisan nature of
unquestionably. I mean, we know from Roberts' public speeches in recent years that this is already well before the sort of carnival atmosphere that emerged this past week and the sort of heightened, you know, dialed up to 11 situation that we have here. Roberts was already concerned about this dynamic. Hmm. He has been an incredible sort of devoted custodian of the court's public perception, its legitimacy, its integrity as an institution. He spoke in 2016 about his concerns just about these hearings in general, the Senate hearings in general, and the concern that people would think of them as Democrats on the one side and Republicans on the other side, and that they were infected with this partisan conversation that he feared would follow nominees to the court in ways that were unfair, that the public perception would not be able to break from that and would not be able to see the court as a neutral, nonpartisan entity that was engaging in judicial behavior rather than political behavior. And if he was concerned about that before this, we can imagine that after, Kavanaugh's sort of coming out swinging and saying things in his opening remarks about pent-up anger about Trump and about calculated orchestrated political hits and about
mentioning the Clintons.
Revenge on behalf of the Clintons, right? Money from left-wing opposition groups. This kind of pointing, you know, with his finger to the Democrats on the side of the panel and physically saying to them, you are causing this and I am on the other side. That kind of dynamic cannot sit well with Chief Justice Roberts, who we should note, you know, for your listeners who don't follow the court really closely, the period of time that someone sits as Chief Justice becomes known as their name court, right? The Roberts Court is what this era is going to be called. And there have only been 17 Chief Justices in the course of history. And no one wants to be the person who is, on the watch at the time that the court takes this massive hit in terms of its public dignity and its integrity as a neutral arbiter of the law. And so he has to be, I think, quite concerned about the legitimacy and integrity and public perception of the court at this moment.
Yeah.
One wonders why there isn't what I'm going to call the grown-up in the room that thought, you know what, maybe this isn't worth it. Now, I know as a personal matter for Judge Kavanaugh, again, if you're offered the opportunity to be on the Supreme Court, you obviously will go to great lengths, and he's shown that he will go to extraordinary lengths, digging up deep, deep things in that testimony. But, you know, one does wonder here, have we done not only damage to the Supreme Court, but to the country? And at what point does someone say, this isn't worth it? Yeah. There are many, many other well-qualified individuals to be on the Supreme Court. It may not be worth it to Judge Kavanaugh to take this hit personally. It may not be worth it to the institutions that we're talking about that I think have suffered extraordinary damage at this point. That's really tough.
The New York Times Supreme Court reporter Adam Liptak wrote this last week. He wrote, ideology has long figured in the Supreme Court's work, but a sharp partisan split on the court is a recent phenomenon. He said confirmation fights now reflect this new reality.
Yeah. I mean, as recently as the time when Amy and I served as law clerks on the court, there were justices on the court who were nominated by Republican presidents who were thought of as members of the court's liberal bloc, right, in key divisive sort of culture war sorts of cases. And throughout history, the converse has also been true. People who were nominated by Democrats who veered to the right.
Disappointed the partisans.
Right. Disappointments to their nominating presidents, but also really great reflectors of what the court is supposed to be, this sort of least dangerous branch, right? It's an entity where they are not responsible to the electorate. They don't go back to the ballot box. They're supposed to be reading the Constitution and engaging in its interpretation in ways that they deem right over the course of lifetime tenure. And since 2010 or so, that hasn't been true. There hasn't been anybody on the court who isn't voting in lockstep with the ideology of the president who nominated them. And that amplifies this public perception issue, right? Justice Kagan gave a speech to some law students in California last week. She was very careful.
Very careful.
She said, I am not answering questions about the Kavanaugh nomination or the hearings, but she did say that the court's strength as an institution of American governance depends on people believing it has a certain kind of legitimacy. Yeah. And the tenor of that comment, right, that it's not just an extension of politics, but it has a decision-making integrity to it that is different in kind and not just in degree than what happens in the elected branches, is the sort of thing that they're sort of scrambling desperately to hold on to. And it's really central to what the court does. The court doesn't have a budget like Congress. It has no purse, right? It can't withhold money from anyone who doesn't obey its rulings. And it doesn't have an army like the executive, right? It can't, if it says to you, this is the rule of law, and you choose not to obey it, it really has nothing but its own goodwill that keeps everyone following its commands.
Yeah. And so all it has is its legitimacy.
Literally, its legitimacy and its goodwill with the American people and with its concomitant branches of government is all that sustains it as an institution. And Chief Justice John Roberts and the other justices on the court have a very heightened awareness of this. And I think at these moments when the court is in the spotlight and when the court is in the spotlight and a spotlight that is distinctly partisan in nature, they have to be very squeamish about it.
If Kavanaugh is confirmed, is there some reason to believe, Amy, that his objectivity related to liberal causes or liberal plaintiffs is now compromised? Should progressives or Democrats be worried about a spurned Brett Kavanaugh, for example?
I mean, I think that's a hard question because we'd have to disentangle sort of where he was before this. He was a consistent conservative view on the D.C. circuit. There's never been a question about that. So it would be tricky to sort of say, you know, all of this happened as a result of the hearing. Now, that said, these are human beings.
Right.
And who knows what to expect, right? But I would anticipate that you would see the same sort of judicial approach that he had embraced on the D.C. circuit. I don't think this changes that in some dramatic way.
We haven't had a chance to actually talk about this, and I wanted to get, Amy, your sense of whether or not Kavanaugh is a good choice. As a jurist, as a thinker, as a writer, about his capacity to be open-minded and measured, what do you think about Kavanaugh in that way?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that Judge Kavanaugh was, while on the D.C. Circuit and continues to be, of course, a member of the D.C. Circuit, his opinions were viewed as, very strong, good opinions. He would not have been nominated to this position if he was not viewed as someone who was well qualified. Now, of course, one of the selection criteria for this particular president is to reflect certain judicial philosophy and certain outcomes. He certainly reflected that. But we should say, as far as his judicial opinions, he was very well qualified to be considered for this spot. So I don't think that that raises any questions, again, about what his competence is as a judge. One of the questions that is going to arise is that when we have somebody pressed into a corner in this kind of way, a corner, by the way, that may have been of his own making, which we could talk about, and we see other things in terms of his temperament, in terms of his approach, does that change our view of whether he really is qualified to be in that spot? So it doesn't change his opinions, his long service on the D.C. Circuit that everyone would agree has been respectable. There's nothing in there to indicate otherwise. But now has there been some shift in how we view what he's done?
What do you mean by his own making?
So one question that I think we can fairly raise at this point is why we got to this spot. I mean, we have lots of disclosure that's required of nominees for the Supreme Court. How did we get to a place where so little was known about this, seemingly, so little came out about it until this very end. And now we're all scrambling, trying to figure out exactly what happened when. And I have to say, it reminds me a lot of what we do with our sort of entering law students. And we say to them, because they're going to have to satisfy the character and fitness test for the bar, we say, tell us everything.
Yeah.
And one has to wonder, given the approach that Judge Kavanaugh has taken in the hearings of these sort of extremes of what he'll say and what he'll do, you have to wonder, has he really disclosed everything? And does that give us some concern? And if he disclosed everything and there were folks who said, but we won't bring this up, or, you know, what were people thinking? This is not an age where you can just sort of have things fester in a corner. That isn't going to work anymore. You got to come forward and you got to say, here's everything, and let's talk about it.
Mm. Right. And the position of Kavanaugh supporters, to be clear, is that his searing reaction to these recent accusations is evidence of their falsehood, right? Or evidence that they are the political hit job that he's described them to be, right? That the only way that he could adequately convey to the American public the depth of his disgust with this, with these lies,
or his innocence,
and his innocence is to come out swinging,
yeah.
Right? And indeed, in some of the coverage that I saw, I was sort of making my way through all the cable news networks to try to see across the political spectrum what people were saying. And every commentator in the break between Dr. Ford's testimony and his time before the panel was saying he's going to have to be adamant, right? And the question is whether, right, it's a very strange box to be placed in, to have to defend yourself against something that you want the American public to know you deny, and you want to strongly deny it, but you also want to be perceived as judicial. And the truth is that judicial behavior is hard to pull off in lots of circumstances.
Yeah. Especially when you're outraged.
Yeah, when you are emotional and upset.
But isn't that the time you're supposed to be judicial?
That I think that's the central point here. And I think the other thing that just strikes everyone as really odd is that, it seems to have gone to extremes.
Yeah.
I was the perfect teenager. Well, no, I wasn't. I really like beer. I mean, we're getting all kinds of mixed messages instead of one that seems like a believable storyline for somebody who was in high school. We were all in high school. We've all done things. Isn't it just better to face up to that? And again, you know, for all those future law students who are listening, this is a great lesson. Tell us everything. Let us help you, right? Work through that. Being honest from the get-go will make it much better in the long run.
This is so interesting, talking to you like you're political pundits. there is one more question related to that I did want to ask. And we do need to mention that the motives of Democrats have come into question as well, whether or not, in fact, it was necessary to reveal, as somebody did, we don't know who, the name of Dr. Ford in all of this, and whether this could have been negotiated and dealt with in private before it became public.
Yeah, I think the political motivations that are at stake here are actually not something that the three of us are talking about for the first time. If we think back to the show that we did after Kennedy's retirement announcement came down, the only thing that we could be certain of was that the next steps would be the most outrageous political gamesmanship maybe in the history of the court, right? Mm-hmm. Because that seat matters.
Yeah.
That seat matters, and that seat has been contended over, and that seat was the subject of the Merrick Garland episode during the final year of the Obama administration. And we just folks like us who follow the Supreme Court are not totally accustomed to Supreme Court issues being so central to the political dialogue in the way that they were in this last presidential election and in the way that they have been since Kennedy's retirement. And everybody is vested in a way that we really haven't seen in recent years, and even didn't see with the Gorsuch nomination, because Gorsuch was a replacement for Scalia and it was sort of a one for one. But this is a seat that is shifting the balance of the court. The Democrats know it and are fired up in ways that many folks have suggested, right, they haven't seen in the past from Democrats who are fighting for the seat. The same is true on the Republican side, right? All eggs are in this basket. This was a campaign promise. This matters to the midterms. And so we have seen the ugliness of politics, right, amped up as far as it can go surrounding this seat because of the stakes that everyone knows we have here.
Rennell Anderson-Jones is with us. She teaches law at the University of Utah. Amy Wildermuth, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. And we'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the first Monday in October. It's the first Monday in October. It's the beginning of the term for the United States Supreme Court. And so we're intending to preview these cases and issues. But of course, we've been talking about the thing that everyone's talking about, and that is the confirmation, the very emotional confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh, and the condition of the country's highest court after all this dust settles. We have with us Rennell Anderson-Jones. She's a law professor at the University of Utah. Amy Wildermuth, dean of the law school at the University of Pittsburgh. And Rennell, you mentioned this is the moment of John Roberts. He's become incredibly important now that Kennedy's gone. And the question is, does he somehow move into the swing vote role? Does he somehow become more moderate? What do you see the court makeup going? How? Because he's interested in that balance, right? Or at least to some degree.
Yeah. I don't know that swing is the label I would apply to it, but the median justice for sure, right? If you take the nine justices and you try to figure out who's in the middle, it used to be Kennedy. And that meant something because Kennedy sometimes voted with a block of liberals and sometimes voted with a block of conservatives. The new median justice, just statistically speaking, in terms of the conservative to progressive range, is Chief Justice John Roberts. But whether that means that we will see his votes shift in ways that become more swing-like, I think remains to be seen. Some of the things that we were just talking about in terms of his heightened sense of the court's need to be incremental, to be seen as nonpartisan, to be seen as sort of having integrity in judicial decision making, may well act as pressures on him in this regard. And I think we've seen some episodes in the past that suggest that he might be persuaded to do those sorts of things in the name of institutional legitimacy.
Robert Barnes of the Washington Post said that we should all be expecting more of a gradual climb than a jackrabbit acceleration. Roberts is going to be easing up, I guess.
That's because what Roberts would want, right? Yep. In terms of long-term institutional integrity, he does not want to be seen as an institution that's out in front of things, but rather is doing only what it has to do, right? That's how you maintain legitimacy in judicial review, is you say, we decided this case because we had no choice but to do so. Not, we're out there grabbing at all of the hot-button social issues and trying to dictate how people live their lives. He would prefer the former to the latter.
That said, Roberts does have very clear opinions on, we think, abortion rights, on affirmative action and other race-conscious decisions, on voting restrictions, on gun rights, on campaign finance, those kinds of things. And we know where he leans.
I think that's absolutely correct. But I think what we're really going to see now is a similar take as we saw last term, which was very narrow opinions, not going too far. We thought they were going to answer all these blockbuster questions. They did not. I think in shaping the docket, we'll have a narrower set of cases that'll come along. They won't look as exciting from the outside. The ones that look exciting, I would imagine we'll see very narrow approaches. And again, because he's the Chief Justice, he typically, if he's in the majority, he's going to have the assignment power, which means he's going to decide who writes the opinion. That's going to be critical as they move forward.
I think it's also really interesting to see what happens in these early cases regarding precedent.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few. Gamble is one of these cases, and there are a few that you've both mentioned that may give us some sense what the Roberts Court thinks about precedent. Let's talk a little bit about that. What are we seeing? How are we seeing this particular case and, in general, this question of precedent shaping out?
Yeah, the Gamble case is a case involving a doctrine called double jeopardy. It's a rule, a constitutional rule, that says that when a person is tried for a crime on particular facts, they can't be tried for it again on those same facts, right? That you can only be subjected to the criminal process once. But it has a major exception that is very, very old and has long been recognized, called the separate sovereign exception. The idea is that if you committed a set of acts that are a crime for one sovereign, let's call it the federal government, and it also happens to be a crime for another sovereign, the state government, you can be tried in both federal court for a federal crime and in state court the state crime, and it doesn't run afoul of the double jeopardy clause. There is a case that the court has accepted that it's going to hear this week called Gamble that challenges this exception, which is a really interesting turn of events on a bunch of fronts, right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting as a matter of textualism, right? Because if we read the double jeopardy language in the Constitution, textually it doesn't say, except if there's another sovereign. It doesn't say that. So
seems clear.
To the extent that we have a sort of textualist move on the court, that might be the notion. But it also really resonates with another theme that we've seen at the court, which is this doctrine of federalism, the idea that the federal government is its own entity, but the states are their own standalone sovereigns, right? They are not the underlings of the federal government. They are their own entities that have a right to enforce criminal law and indeed have the predominant right in our historical framework to be looking out for the health and safety and welfare and morals of their people. And so
they can shut down abortion clinics, even though there is a Roe versus Wade presumption of a right there?
Right. Well, so this would be more a criminal dynamic about whether when I'm charged with a crime, can I be charged with that crime by the state and by a state prosecutor and then charged with the crime on a federal level? And one context in which this might be of heightened interest at the particular moment is in the context of pardons. So loads of people have been anticipating Gamble and have been thinking about it in the context of Paul Manafort and others who have been charged with, who are associated with the Trump campaign and who have been charged with federal crimes and who could, of course, be pardoned
by the president.
By the president for those federal crimes.
But then could they turn around and be prosecuted by the
state? That's
right.
Currently, they could be, right? Yeah. Because the state still retains, notwithstanding the double jeopardy bar, they could still be charged by the state, which means that the president's capacity to pardon his way out of a situation is limited because there remains this possibility of these state prosecutions. If this case came out differently, there's at least some possibility that that dynamic shifts. And that makes people really interested in the Gamble case, despite it not really being about that.
Yeah.
Now, the only thing that's a little difficult with Gamble is that we have signals that Justice Thomas and Justice Ginsburg agree on this. So it may tell us very little about what Chief Justice Roberts might do in the end. There's also this very interesting dynamic as we're talking about this. You can feel that this is really kind of pro-defendant. In this particular case, Gamble was convicted a felon, and he was found with a gun. The state indicted him. He was punished with a year in jail. Then the federal government came after him. They want to punish him up to 4 years. It's about 4 years in jail. And so the idea that they would get rid of this doctrine, again, very pro-defendant. So where does that end up, right? This is a really, I don't know how much this one's going to tell us about what might happen with prior precedent, but there's certainly two others, Nick and Hyatt, that might give us a little more insight. Now, remember, though, Chief Justice Roberts has given us a little preview of what he thinks about overturning prior precedent from the last term. And he's very hesitant to do so. That's what he said. And so I think this will be a real test to see where he's going.
The only reason I mentioned that Roe versus Wade in this context was the idea. I wonder what the court is going to indicate in terms of granting state sovereignty over, you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, 'cause the idea is that Robert Barnes makes this case in the Washington Post that Roberts has the tools to move the court very gradually without setting off too many alarms. And one of the ways he may do it is just say, well, the state can do what they want. We'll grant them the capacity.
Now, we have to remember that as we're moving gradually, things will also change, right? These are not set in stone. Things may happen at the Supreme Court. Things may happen in elections that will change the dynamic around the Supreme Court. So if you're a progressive and you're looking for something here to be happy about, there's not much. But one thing you could say is that at least it appears that the Chief Justice is going to go very slowly, and he's going to want the court to go very slowly. And no matter what for, they're going to need a fifth for most of these cases, except for that weird gamble case where Ginsburg and Thomas are together.
Are in, yeah.
Very strange, right? So I think we'll see a more gradual approach on most of these issues as we go forward.
And for the moment, at least, the court is down to eight. And this is not this is sort of a strange dynamic because this is the second time in 3 years that it's been down to eight. Right. So we saw that entire time where the Merrick Garland nomination was stalled. And there's a reason why the court is at nine.
Yeah.
Nine is a number that does not evenly divide. Yeah. And so we don't have ties. And we find ourselves. So even the cases that we're just talking about, Gamble and others that are being argued before the court this week that are set for oral argument today and tomorrow and the next day, those cases, even if we imagined that Kavanaugh or a Kavanaugh replacement was placed on the court very quickly, let's say, you know, next week or a couple of weeks or even a month down the line, those opinions won't yet be released.
Yeah.
But the new justice may not vote in them. The court rules suggests that you have to be present for oral argument in order to participate in an opinion. So we are, by definition, down to a 4-4 situation for at least the first portion of the term. And perhaps, depending on what happens with the nomination, we're at 4-4 for quite some time.
But on those 4-4 cases, 2 points. One, they could re-argue them. So if they know they went 4-4, they could be re-argued and then decided. The second point that we should just say to everyone out there is that if they go 4-4, the practice of the Supreme Court is to affirm by an evenly divided court, which means that the holding below will be upheld.
Hmm.
But it means no national precedent.
Correct.
So if this case came from the Ninth Circuit, the answer is just you, the Ninth Circuit, continue to keep that rule. You, the litigant, get an answer. But we don't get the kind of thing that we're actually seeking from the Supreme Court, which is the resolution of divides that are nationwide. And it could leave us with the weird situation of the Constitution meaning one thing in New York and a different thing in California.
Okay, I want to ask about the death penalty. There's this case before the court where the justices have to decide whether Vernon Madison should be executed in Alabama. Now Madison is 67. He's had two devastating strokes. He has dementia and no recollection of the murder that he was convicted of.
Correct.
So a psychologist has said that that Madison has these this cognitive decline, but also that he does understand what he's been accused of and what the state is planning to do. And the attorney general says that's enough. Now, talk a little bit about this case. What are we seeing that's significant about this?
So I think in this case, this is where we will see the difference in the court without a Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy was at the forefront of most of the decisions, the recent decisions in the Eighth Amendment context involving the death penalty. And my guess would have been that in this kind of case, he would have been sympathetic I think we should also mention that this is an individual who has spent a great deal of time on death row, which is a phenomenon that we are witnessing across the country. Yeah. My former boss, Justice Stevens, had a particular view of that. He thought that was a claim in and of itself under the Eighth Amendment, that if you spent too much time on death row, that's cruel and unusual in and of itself. But I think this is one where we will see a difference, that if there's a Judge Kavanaugh to become a Justice Kavanaugh, this may mean that, you know, it wouldn't be seen as sympathetically as it might have with a Justice Kennedy on the court.
Kennedy's death penalty jurisprudence sometimes doesn't get talked about as much as his other sort of swing votes in really critical sort of culture war kinds of dynamics. But he was a critical fifth vote in some very important, the line of Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment cases that were brought about because of Justice Kennedy's presence on the court, finding it unconstitutional to execute juveniles, those who are mentally insane, those who have intellectual disabilities. That all came about at Kennedy's hand. And so was the sort of teeing up of this next question, which is the one that the Madison case brings about, right? What if the person was of sound mind at the time and is of sound enough mind to understand that that execution is happening for a crime but cannot himself recall that he participated in that crime, that he committed it? We can assume, I think, that Kennedy, before leaving the court, voted in this case to stop the execution. So this person was to have been executed in January, and there was a halt to the execution, and Kennedy presumably voted with the justices who voted to halt the execution. And so now we have this interesting dynamic in which the execution was halted with Kennedy's assistance, but he's no longer around to make the case law about how the actual dynamic plays out in terms of the jurisprudence.
Does Roberts have a kind of calculus that he's thinking about in broad themes? I'll go along with a death penalty case because another landmark sort of question, abortion, something else may come up that'll give me some currency there. Do you think that's how he thinks?
I don't know if that's how he thinks through these issues, but it wouldn't be surprising if we were to see a narrow opinion with perhaps the Chief Justice doing something somewhat unexpected in the death penalty context. I wouldn't be entirely surprised by that, but I wouldn't expect it. I think that it would be quite unusual for him in his past death penalty cases. He hasn't given any indication that that would be of interest to him. But given that there is so much attention that's getting paid to the Supreme Court now, one wonders what that might inspire in terms of how the Supreme Court might come out in different issues. I wouldn't be surprised if this could be a narrow win for Madison, but we'll see.
A Chief Justice has a really interesting spot, and particularly the Chief Justice who is the new median justice, right? He, on the one hand, he feels the pressures of his own past jurisprudence. He wants to be consistent with the positions that he's taken, right? He has a fully developed jurisprudence in some of these areas. But on the other hand, he's concerned about the court's trajectory. And we saw, for example, just a couple of years ago in the Obamacare case, where he was the critical vote to uphold that piece of legislation that was quite popular as a national movement, right, and that showed showing some deference to the legislature, the politically accountable bodies, in ways that loads of people thought might have been motivated by his incentives as chief to be able to do things incremental and not in a partisan way.
We're essentially out of time. And Amy, I know you wanted to talk about the dusky gopher frog, but we don't have time. That's an endangered species case, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point.
And it's remarkable they even took an endangered species that case.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah,
right?
I do want to
we'll
talk about that.
See.
But we'll wait for another time. Let me just ask you finally, will anything good come out of this fraught confirmation process, do you think?
Oh, I mean, I think it's too early to say. At this point, you know, so far what we've seen on display is a lot of ambition, a lot of hopes and dreams, right, for those who may aspire to the Supreme Court. Certainly lots of lessons about how this process unfolds. You know, maybe we'll learn a little bit more about what everyone needs to disclose ahead of time. I mean, I think that would be an excellent lesson to come away from this, especially for those young and aspiring folks, to realize that we have all been in high school at some point in our lives, and maybe that's a better approach. But so far, it looks like it has damaged the Supreme Court and, of course, again, to me, highlighted the dysfunction in Congress.
Quick final thought.
I think notwithstanding the very significant damage that the last week has done, there are lots of upsides, right? We're having really important conversations that are outgrowths of the Me Too movement. We're having important conversations about qualifications for the bench and about and holding our senators accountable for the ways that they treat allegations. I think all of that holds the promise of pulling us to a better place in the future.
Agreed.
Ronelle Anderson-Jones teaches law here at the University of Utah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Amy Wildermuth, thanks for making the trip back home. She, of course, is the dean at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.